Hello and welcome to the first episode of Homer Grown, a bi-weekly show about gardening. The intent of this show is to provide diverse voices to encourage, empower, and educate local gardeners through interviewing local experts, garden enthusiasts, and through independent research. We hope to provide content relevant to both the professional and amateur gardener alike, specific to the microclimates and conditions of Ketchikan Bay. We wish to illustrate the unique ways that different individuals approach gardening by presenting material that corresponds to the natural rhythm of summer gardening. It is our hope that the listener can apply information and techniques gleaned from the show to their personal garden. As gardening is both an individual and communal pursuit, issues relevant to the larger scope of gardening, agriculture, and sustainability will be addressed. Although this show is called Homer Grown, I want to acknowledge the other communities that could consider this information applicable. These communities include Fritz Creek, Anchor Point, Nanwalek, Soldovia, to name a few. I'm very happy that this first episode also corresponds to the first day of the Homer Farmers Market, so go out there and support your local farmers. A brief introduction. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska, that specializes in mushroom cultivation, although we also grow vegetables, raise animals, and keep bees. Gardening is a personal passion of mine, and there's always something to learn, and I hope that you will join me for my journey. For this first episode, we interview Carrie Restino from Homer Hilltop Farms at her farm in Homer, Alaska, on May 17th. We talk to Brad Kassar from the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District about soil blockers, and we join Nicole Arevalo and Catherine Shakey to talk about the invasive European bird cherry and choke cherry. For the first segment, we talked to Carrie Restino of Homer Hilltop Farm about the transition from winter to summer and about seed starting. First, I just wanted you to introduce yourself and the farm.
Sure. I'm Carrie Restino, and this is Homer Hilltop Farm. We've got 15 acres up on Diamond Ridge. We've built this farm with myself, my two children, Liam and Taya, and a huge number of volunteers through the WWOOF USA program and friends who've come up and helped. It's definitely a community effort. We are now in our ninth year of production. We do about half of our production is greens. We're really well known for our salad greens. And we have also a CSA program that does weekly veggie boxes. And that's growing every year. Then we sell at Save You More as well for our greens production.
So because this first episode is about seed starting and kind of the transition in between winter and moving towards summer, I was wondering if you could give the audience a brief outline of how you begin preparing.
Sure. I think it's appropriate that we're sitting right next to a pile of snow while we talk about this. So we start our first starts in the end of January, and that's our tomatoes, leeks, and a few other items, especially flowers and herbs that take a long time to get to maturity. Then by the middle of March, beginning of April, we are planting 25 flats a week, and that's thousands of vegetable starts. So at this point, we've been planting now for months. How we go about our seed starting process is we use primarily ProMix, which is a mix of perlite and peat moss, and we moisten that. We put it in the seed packs. We mix in a little bit of blood meal, a tiny bit in the beginning, and start our seeds. The other thing we really work hard on is our soil temperature. So we make sure all our seeds are started in the house where it's 70 degrees, and we get much better germination that way. The other thing we do is we cover all of our trays with saran wrap so that the moisture stays in until they germinate. And then once they have germinated, we have racks and racks of lights that they go under in the beginning of the season. Then once it warms up enough, we have a nursery that we put them out in. Once they are showing their first true leaves, then we start to bring them out into the greenhouses to get them used to that climate. So I think with any starts, you're babying them. You want to give them the very best beginning life situation. So you don't want them to be stressed out at all. You don't want them to have not enough light. You want those lights to be right on top of your seed starts.
What kind of lights are these?
No, that's another detail question. I should be going to LEDs. I'm just using straight fluorescence shop lights, mainly because like anything in a farm like this, you start with duct tape and baling twine, and then you try and upgrade from there. So that's pretty much one of those things I haven't changed. And there's also a certain element of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I tried some other potting mixes other than ProMix in the past and had complete crop failures. Don't know if that was why, but after that I was like, that's it. I'm only doing ProMix forever. Anyways.
So one question that I personally have, one of my first years gardening, I made the mistake of immediately putting the plants that were indoor with an indoor light outside without acclimating them. Is there a certain way that you acclimate the plants?
Right. So if your plant has lived its entire life in your house under a light and you take it and stick it outside, even on a beautiful day like today, it will get not only sun shock, but wind shock. And you have to protect it against all that by easing it into the transition of being exposed to wind and bright sun and all this sort of stuff. So I start off, it sort of depends on the day. The best time to harden off your plants when they are getting their first dose of harden being outside is a cloudy, calm day. And you could put a plant outside in a cloudy, calm day for 2 or 3 hours and it would be fine. Then the next day, if it was the same kind of conditions, you'd leave it out all day. The third day, you might try leaving it out overnight. But you have to really watch those winds, especially. And then once you put your plants out into the ground, putting some sort of row cover cloth over them for the first week or so was really kind, you know. Lots of plants will live through all kinds of hardships, but they're not going to be as productive if you stress them in their first formative time.
When we were walking, touring your greenhouse or your high tunnels, I noticed that you had certain row covers specifically for plants that you said kept out the slugs.
You
maybe
mean
not
the
slugs,
yeah,
the root the radishes, maggots.
The root maggots. Now that's a detail I do know. Yeah, so there are some times where you will use row cover to keep pests out. And it, especially with salad turnips and radishes, they get infested with root maggots really easily. So most people doing any kind of large scale production of radishes or salad turnips keep the row cover on the plants from the time you seed them all the way through. That way the flies just never have a chance to lay those root maggots.
What are some mistakes that you have made in the past in regard to seed starting or transplanting?
Well, like I said, I have definitely made some big mistakes with using some different blends, and I wound up with one time I used fishbone meal in my starts and wound up with mold on everything. So I'm really careful about what I put in there to begin with. And then the second biggest mistake is just not watering consistently. When you have a tray of seedlings, the edge seedlings always get drier first. And if you're not watching really closely, the ones in the all the way back under those hot lights will dry out and man, they'll be dead in like 2 hours if they don't get enough water. They're not very hardy at that age. So definitely trying to be consistent with your watering, but not overwatering, because if you overwater, the plant can't get any oxygen to its roots and it'll die.
Have you noticed any visual signs from the plant in regards to if you overwater?
So how I teach my folks to tell if a plant is properly watered is by picking the actual seed pack up. And you'll gauge, you'll get so you understand what is too light, meaning it's way too dry, and what's too heavy, meaning it's overwatered and waterlogged. And I think that's the best way, because you really can't tell from, you know, if it's dark on the top, like it looks like it's properly watered, but the two-thirds of the seed pack is actually bone dry. You can't tell that unless you pick it up.
And when we were walking around, you mentioned that you get a lot of your seeds from Johnny's.
Yep.
Do you have other places that you prefer to get your varieties from?
Yeah, Johnny's is like two-thirds of my seeds, definitely. Part of that is just you want to order from one place. I use Jung seeds. I don't know if actually it's Jung or Young. So Jung seeds for one variety of broccoli that I really like. And then high mowing seeds, I do a little bit from them. But I just universally like to use the varieties I've tried before, and Johnny's has been super consistent. Plus, they're based in kind of the same temperate climate as Alaska, and so I think they have good varieties for us.
Do you have any advice for a novice gardener?
I think that the key to success when you're starting out is to make things easy for yourself. You can do that by trying to keep the weeds at bay in a variety of different ways, using weed block, keeping Remay on things, and also making sure that you're not starting with soil that's really full of weeds. So trying to start off your beds clean. I would get your soil tested. That would be number two. And lime is probably the biggest thing. Our soils here are 4.3, which is super acidic. I was just offering some advice to a friend of mine up the road, and I said, you know, on this little bed that's maybe 20 by 20 garden, I would put probably 25 pounds of lime, and they were totally shocked by that. But that's my experience, is, you know, for the first 2 or 3 years, you need to add a lot of lime every single season. So get your soils tested and then follow those recommendations to a T. And then the third thing is get a really great water system going. Buy yourself a little timer, set up the hoses, set up some sort of irrigation system, whether it's T-tape or anything like that. Because we all have tons of energy this time of year when we're putting things in the ground and it's all great and wonderful. But then our lives get busy. We're fishing, we're doing this, we're doing that. And if you don't have a good system in place, your best intentions are going to get eaten by slugs and overgrown by chickweed. And so do it right to begin with.
So you operate mostly off drip lines. Mm-hmm. with a timer.
Yeah, we have a lot of timers. Yep.
We were talking about the irrigation system, and you were talking about the grant from the
NRCS. So there is a program. It's pretty extensive. You have to monitor your water levels, your soil moisture levels, on a daily basis throughout the life of the grant.
Was it one specifically for water?
Yeah. It's a water conservation grant. So the idea is to try and use as little water as possible. So you're trying not to overwater things. But they actually designed a whole system for us, for this farm, which has, you know, 500 feet of main line and thousands of feet of irrigation drip line. So it's pretty complicated stuff.
A lot of the world right now is kind of different because of COVID-19. Has anything changed in regards to your gardening this season as opposed to another one? Or are there any challenges that you are facing or fears that you have?
Well, the big thing that has changed is that people have woken up to the issue of food security in a way that I could not have imagined could happen that quickly. I think just seeing bare shelves at the grocery store made people realize that their local farmers are really, really important. And it's been so heartwarming because this is something, you know, that I'm obviously very passionate about, or I wouldn't spend every waking hour working on this farm. It's wonderful to see so many other people starting to recognize what's going on in the world. The thing about this year is people started calling me in March wanting to get on the Veggie Box program. We have 2 more shares left, which is crazy. We've never been sold out like this. We always sell everything, but I've never had this much advance interest. We've had to do a lot more online stuff. We got a new website and are doing online sales so people can pre-order for the farmers market and also doing delivery. So all those components will take some time to figure out, and they're all new, and trying to figure out how to use credit card systems and stuff is all new. And anytime you're doing something for the first time, it takes 10 times as long. And as far as being a small-scale farmer in this particular climate, you know, we are so lucky to have the support of the community. We're really feeling buoyed by that. The only real frustrations I've had are all of our, sometimes we've used volunteers from the lower 48 who've come through, and that is completely no go. We can't do that this year at all. So that's a shift, but it was one that we were already kind of headed in that direction anyways. But I hope, you know, to return to that too, because educating people about small-scale agriculture is part of what we're doing here, so.
This is a little off the topic, but kind of just a personal question that I'm curious about is your high tunnels, instead of having a vent on the doors, you have vents on the sides where you manually use a pulley system.
Yeah, they call it drop down sides instead of roll up sides, which most of these tunnels will come with roll up sides. We got our first one from FarmTech, had the drop down sides. And I love that so much for our climate, especially when we put those plants out there in the beginning of April. It's very cold outside and it can get 80 degrees in the tunnel and you need to cool things off a little bit, but you don't want to hit them with a 30 degree breeze. You know, the day breeze picks up and your little plants are getting frostbite. So having the drop down sides allows airflow to fluctuate through the tunnels without actually blasting the little plants. So it's really good for the shoulder seasons on both sides.
What are you excited about for this season?
I'm just excited that so many other people are excited about local food and local food production. I mean, it is so wonderful to produce food for people who really appreciate it. And there's lots of those people in the community always, but there seems to be way more now. Oh, can I say something about succession planting?
Yes.
Okay. So I hear again and again from people, there's a really funny flow at the farmers market. Lots of people, pretty much most of the people who go to the farmers market, have a garden of their own. And because we sell so many greens, I see this. There's a point in late June, early July, where our green sales at the farmers market drop off quite a bit. And I know that all of a sudden people's veggie patches are producing lettuce, right? Wonderful. And then the third week in July, usually when it starts to get rainy, our green sales jump through the roof all over again. And it's because their lettuce starts have either gone to seed or got eaten by slugs or are just old and bitter. So one of the things that we do here at the farm is we continually start lettuces and some other things too. Even peas you can do a couple of succession plantings on. So we're starting, but with the lettuces specifically, we are planting 7 successions throughout the year. So we are planting new lettuce starts every 3 weeks. It's hard to remember, so maybe stick it in your phone or something like that to just get out there and throw a couple more seed trays together, because you won't be able to buy them at the greenhouses. They stop selling. So you're really pretty much on your own to get those late season. And so you can plant lettuces every 3 weeks. And then the last planting, you need to plant your starts around the beginning of August. So you'll start some starts at the beginning of August. You'll plant them out the middle of August. And that if you do a bunch at that time, if we get a fairly mild fall, you can have kale, chard, lettuces of all varieties. They'll withstand all the way down to like 25 degrees, especially if you put some row cover over them. So then you extend your capacity to have greens coming out of your garden for months by doing that. So that would be my one big piece of advice, is to keep starting.
How do people keep their lettuce from bolting around the solstice?
Well, you could try using shade cloth. I just replant. Yeah, and also, you know, if you have anything in any kind of a covered situation, you want to start moving it outside definitely by the beginning of June. We transition all of our greens production from the tunnel to the outside gardens and then back in again, because it's too hot in a covered situation.
That's why all your greens in the high tunnel were so close together, because you're going to thin them out by taking them into the field?
No, that's just how you plant greens in a large scale. You want to keep them short and small. They're not going to get big. The big head lettuces and stuff are 4 rows every 6 inches, but that stuff is 12 rows every, I don't know, half an inch or so.
So it's the difference between a commercial grower and casual gardener.
I mean, that's a dense seed. You're just one step above, you know, microgreens basically. You're not shooting for anything, and those will get cut 2 or 3 times and then replanted, or that will leave the bed until later in the summer.
Can I ask you, what is a Jang cedar, and do you use one?
Yeah, so we have 2 cedars that we use. One is the Jang. Some people call it the Yang. And we use that. It's a precision cedar, but it's a single row cedar. So for our greens, it's not the best, because trying to fit 12 rows through a single row cedar and have it be properly spaced is pretty tricky. So for those greens, we usually use a 6-row cedar, and the 6-row cedar, you just pull it behind. But it's a little more finicky. You have to have a very perfect seed bed. You can't have a bunch of rocks or roots or clumps or anything like that.
Is it a manual?
Yep. Yeah, but both of those tools are pretty expensive for a small scale. You know, anybody doing their own gardening or anything like that, you probably wouldn't want that investment. This farm, they just barely make sense at this scale. But you can go out and densely seed your greens like I have there. If you're just doing 10 feet just by, you know, kind of evenly shaking them out, and you'll get great density that way. So for us, having them perfectly spaced not only is really nice to look at, but it also allows us to use a cultivation tool to run right between each row, so we can knock down the weeds. And if they don't have perfect row, you can't do that. You have to hand weed, which takes time, thus making it not financially possible to survive. But yeah, the Jang is an awesome tool. They now sell a 5-row Jang, which is what everybody's using now. The 6-row cedar is getting kind of obsolete because it's so persnickety. It has to have perfect soil. Basically, like if you bought compost, you know, like fishy peat or something that's perfectly clean, and laid it on there, that's has to be compacted, but not too compacted, not too wet, not too dry.
Is it Jang, just spelled J-A-N-G?
Yeah. A lot of these tools come from Asia, small-scale gardening. You want to start anything that you wouldn't want to direct seed anything that you could wind up with 20% germination failure. If you do it in a tray, then once you transplant out, you've got 100% of your space used. If you direct seed and you don't get perfect germination, which you rarely do, you've lost a whole bunch of space. It's just efficiency. For that stuff, you have to direct seed. It would take a really long time to transplant all that stuff. And carrots, you have to direct seed. We use the Jang for the carrot. It's a lot of, we've done a lot of tooling up here in the last couple years. I'm not sorry. It's really made life a lot easier. We have this awesome quick cut greens harvester. It's like a little mowing machine. And then we have this flame weeder that's got like five. It goes like, it's awesome. Liam always likes to use that, my son. He's 16. And
can you briefly describe flame weeding?
So creating a stale seed bed is something that's really important anytime you're direct seeding into the soil instead of using transplants. Although you could do it when you're transplanting in as well. So the idea is you create your garden bed, put your amendments in, tilth it, do everything except plant it, and then you water it, and then you wait, usually 10 days at the least, depending on the temperature. Once the chickweeds and grasses that are inevitable in our soil germinate, you come along with either a flame weeder or use a tarp to smother the seeds. And so what you're doing is you're germinating all the seeds that are in the top couple inches of your garden bed, and then you're killing them. And then you plant into that carefully. You don't mix the soil up. You don't mess around with anything that you don't have to. You just make your rows, you seed and water things. And that gives your plants a jump start. So they'll have at least a weed-free existence for like 2 or 3 weeks, or at least a low weed pressure situation. So by then, those, you know, say it's carrots, for example, the carrot tops will start to shade out the ground and the weeds will be less able to thrive. And so that's the perfect situation, is to just have a weed-free first few weeks. In carrots' case, be more like a month or month and a half, if you can, so they don't have any competition.
You don't want to transplant root vegetables.
I even transplant radishes, but I don't transplant carrots because they get wonky. I did it 1 year thinking I'd have these dancing carrots, because, you know, if you have the first carrots of the year at the market, it's you're the god, right? And I thought kids will love dancing carrots. One problem with dancing carrots, it takes hours to clean a carrot that's all...
Oh, like when you plant them close together and they get intertwined.
Exactly. Well, if you transplant a carrot, they are all funky. They are like, they look like they've been through an earthquake. So you're like hand washing every single carrot individually. So that was the end of my dancing carrots adventure. It was a good idea, though. It's all an adventure, you know, like one of my employees, Kimber, was asking me, have you ever had any crop failures? And I just started laughing because every single year there's things that I experiment with or different conditions cause certain things. And just every year you learn another layer of experience to add to the other layers of experience. And I think about the great farmers like Elliot Coleman, and he's been doing this for probably 40, 50 years, and he's still coming out with new tools and new ideas and new strategies for dealing with things. You can never stop learning when it comes to farming, which frankly is kind of why I love it. It is the ultimate challenge. Speaking of which, I should probably get back to work because this is one of the few days where I have space and time.
And sun. It's so nice.
It's gorgeous, I know. Anyway, but thank you for doing this program. It's really great to get more people inspired to farm, and there's certainly lots of interest in it this year. If I had 5 minutes for every person who calls me asking for advice, I'd use up days and days and days.
A lot of it is just wanting to know what I'm doing wrong and hoping that other people don't make those mistakes. And for the next segment, we have your Tech Minute, where Brad Kassar from Homer Soil and Water talks to us about soil blockers.
I'm Brad Ksar with Homer Soil and Water, here with today's Tech Minute talking about soil blockers. It's the time of season to be planting and transplanting. And one of the fun things for transplanting is putting your seedlings into soil blocks. Rather than using the standard plastic trays that are always fun to have extra plastic around, but here with soil blockers, you can create a block within itself that stands sturdy and holds seedlings very well for easy transplanting. What a soil blocker is a small mechanized piece of equipment that some are handheld and some are upright that you can stand and use. They take a mixture of potting medium and create a small block with an indentation for where your seed is going to be planted. And they create that solid block so that you can have your seedling grow into that and easily picked up and moved around outside of a plastic tray. So a fine mixture that's used, that's been practiced and figured out over lots of experimentation. The mixture is about 3 parts peat, 2 parts perlite or sand, 2 parts compost, and 1 part soil. With that, you're going to want to add a bit of lime and base fertilizer for your seedlings, just a little bit. Mix all of that together to a nice moist consistency where you can squeeze it and water is coming out. It might take a few tries to get just the right mix. You can try with your soil blocker, mat it down, and bingo, you have yourself soil blocks. You can put them onto homemade trays, or you can buy trays specially designed for them. There's lots of different size the soil blocks come in for all different uses. Some for larger farms that can produce 20 blocks at once, or smaller ones that are only doing 3 or 4. These soil blocks are a real benefit for transplants and seedlings in general for a few reasons. They are aerated because there's no plastic walls keeping them enclosed, so it helps the roots get more air and grow more evenly throughout the medium. They also stop growing when they hit the wall into the air, and the roots will die back there instead of climbing around your plastic trays like they normally do, which makes for easy transplanting. Less root die-off when you transplant into the ground because there's not a lot of those roots that are all tangled up in your plastic tray. They have lots of other benefits, but they're a fun tool for a gardener or a farmer. The soil blocker is available online, and it can be found on Johnny's website or other places. Suggest you find one and give it a shot. And that's been your Tech Minute here with Homer Soil and Water.
And that was Brad Ksar from Homer Soil and Water. He is the Homer Soil and Water's soil guy. And he was talking about soil blockers. Coming up next, Nicole Arevalo talks with Catherine Shakey, the invasive plants manager at Homer Soil and Water, about the invasive European bird cherry and choke cherry.
Hello, listeners. My name is Nicole Arevalo, and I'm here today with Catherine Shakey from Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. And Catherine is here to talk to us about a bird cherry program that the Soil and Water District is rolling out during National Invasive Species Awareness Week, which in 2020 is being held May 16th through 23rd. Take it away, Catherine.
Thanks, Nicole, and thank you for having me. I am the Invasive Species Program Manager with Homer Soil and Water, and I also coordinate a Kenai Peninsula-wide partnership called the Cooperative Weed Management Area, or the CWMA for short. We are excited to introduce National Invasive Species Awareness Week, and the theme this year is Slow the Spread, which is a very timely catchphrase given the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of the public is learning about what invasive species professionals do on a daily basis, which is track and identify vectors of invasive species and work to minimize the spread of infestations. Just so all of you are aware, an invasive species is not every non-native organism. It becomes invasive when any plant, animal, insect, fungi, or other organisms that live in water and land are causing harm, either economically, environmentally, or to human health.
Great. So, Catherine, you're here to talk to us about bird cherry and a bird cherry removal program. And I'd like to get started with, what is bird cherry? What kind of trees are we talking about? And how would people who aren't already familiar with this identify it and any other names they might know it by?
Thanks, Nicole. Yeah, so the European bird cherry is also known as the Mayday tree. Those are common names for the species Prunus patis. And the choke cherry is the species Prunus virginiana. So these trees are now known to be aggressively invasive in the state of Alaska. Originally, 20 to 35 years ago, they were planted because they're a very hardy ornamental tree that's also very pretty and smells good and attracts the birds. But we now know that it can jump the fence and wreak havoc on our native ecosystems. So you may have seen it before. The ornamental tree itself, it's a deciduous ornamental tree. The genus Prunus has clusters of white fragrant flowers, and they tend to be in long clusters, usually 3 to 6 inches long, and bloom in the early spring, a couple of weeks before your apple trees bloom or any species in the Malus genus. Those leaves have a serrated dull green color, and they are usually about 1 to 4 inches long. They're elliptical in shape. And then in the fall, those leaves turn a bright yellow color, and they seem to hang on a little later than some of the other deciduous trees in Alaska. They can grow to be 20 to 40 feet tall. They have a rounded crown. The berries in the fall are also a good time to identify it, because they have a long cluster of astringent pea-sized small black cherries that have a single big stone on the inside of them. Virginiana, or the choke cherry, often has really beautiful purplish-reddish leaves, but we have seen those trees jump the fence from people's yards and inhabit riparian areas where they will actually lose their ability to turn red. They kind of resort back to their original genetics, and it can be hard to tell the species apart. But for now, you know, we're just interested in finding where the Prunus patis and Prunus virginiana trees are throughout the Homer area.
And what about the bark? What kind of bark are we looking for?
The bark is really variable, so it's not your best way to identify the tree. In general, it's more grayish or brownish, and they have the little white speckled holes for breathing like the alders do.
So we're talking about maydays and choke cherries, but I understand there are many kinds of choke cherry trees out there, so we're just looking for a specific kind, right?
Yeah, so the Prunus trees, it's a whole genus of species, and some are hardier than others and do really well in northern climates. Originally, this tree was introduced as an ornamental, like most Prunus species up here. But the Prunus patis and virginiana are the two species that have been shown to be invasive. Other Prunus species are not as invasive, like your Machii. That one tends to have a more goldish colored bark, hasn't been found to jump the fence as much and outcompete native vegetation. We were talking earlier, there are other varieties of Prunus species that are not known to be invasive, but most of the Prunus trees that have been planted around Alaska as ornamentals are either Prunus patis or virginiana, and those are all known to be invasive.
Am I to understand some have red leaves, but once they jump the fence, the leaves turn green?
So Prunus virginiana, or the choke cherry, was a planted as a very attractive tree because the leaves turn red. And we have seen that they do tend to resort back to some of their original genetics rather than the cultivated varieties once they escape into the wild. So it can be really difficult to tell the difference between species. But for now, what we're really concerned about is if you suspect you have one of these flowering Mayday trees in your yard, or you've seen it along creeks or streams or forested areas, we really want to know about it.
Okay, thank you. If these are considered an invasive species, that means it's causing a problem once it gets out into the habitat. Can you explain that a little bit for us?
Sure, yeah. So they've had a lot of issues in Anchorage with the Mayday trees and bird cherry trees infesting a lot of creek corridors. And that's a problem for a couple of reasons. This tree outcompetes native habitat for moose. It shades out a lot of understory plants that are important for other organisms. Black currants, red currants, blueberries, dwarf dogwood. Those boreal forest understory plants can't compete with the bird cherry trees. It also has a toxin in it that is toxic to moose. They can get cyanide poisoning, actually, if they eat too much of it. The moose learn not to eat it pretty quick, so it often doesn't directly kill moose, but the fact that it displaces native vegetation means the moose have less of their native foods to eat, like willows. They also impact salmon. Would you like to hear about that?
Yes, please.
So our salmon are highly dependent on the insects that grow around alders and then drop into the streams. That's an important food source for our salmon. There was a study done out of UAF where they found that once bird cherry is established along a stream, it changes the insect community. And so that food for salmon is no longer there and dropping into the stream the way it is with native vegetation.
Okay. Changing the insect population. So are we talking about just along riverbanks, or are you talking these smaller tributaries that people might find on other kinds of properties in their yard near wetlands?
Definitely smaller tributaries are at risk as well. So in general, any area that has been disturbed is vulnerable to invasive species growing, invasive weeds growing. But this bird cherry, one of the reasons we're so concerned about it is because those birds transport the fruit to remote areas, and then they seem to be able to sprout and produce saplings and then reproduce, creating a jungle along streams and creek beds.
So are these only propagating along streams and riparian areas and wet places, or are they able to grow kind of anywhere?
They can grow in a more dry forest environment too. So there's an invasiveness ranking that the state of Alaska has for how much of a problem a species is, and it's on a scale of 0 to 100. Usually if something is over 60, we're concerned about it, and the invasive European bird cherry and Mayday trees are ranked a 74.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Solid 74. Yikes. Well, so they're not native to here. How did they get so established up here? How did they come to be here?
Yeah, so invasive species can be introduced intentionally or unintentionally. It just so happens that this tree was promoted as an ornamental tree about 30 years ago. The reason being, it's hard to find ornamental trees that do well in northern environments like Alaska. So this tree was planted widely throughout Anchorage and the Kenai Peninsula and the Matsu Valley as a pretty tree in people's yards. That was before we understood what it could do and how aggressive it would be in moving outside of people's yards.
So they were promoted as something that grows well here that you can look at, but maybe they grow too well.
Right. And that's something that we learned the hard way. Now we're encouraging folks to remove them, which seems a little ridiculous, but it's good to be aware when you are planting ornamentals that you aren't planting something that will later become a problem. And if you have any questions about that along the way, you're always welcome to give us a call at Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, or call your local conservation district or cooperative extension service.
Okay, great. So people planted them in their yards, and now they're established as part of the landscape in many of these yards. Tell us about the bird cherry removal program that the district is putting on.
Yeah, thanks. So we are launching this program. It's new this year. We have two goals. We want to survey where the trees are so we understand how much of a problem has this Mayday tree and bird cherry tree become in the Homer area. And then we also want to encourage you to remove it. And in order to remove the tree, it is tricky. You have to kill the roots, and there's a variety of methods that you can use. But by far the best tactic to save yourself a headache later is to cut the tree down, and within 10 minutes of cutting it down, you need to apply the correct herbicide and the correct amount of herbicide into the cut stump so that it will be absorbed into the root system. If you're not comfortable with the use of herbicide, there are alternative ways to deal with it. Digging up the root system can be a huge pain. The roots are aggressive and they spread underground and they wrap around the roots of other trees and can be a pretty gnarly endeavor to dig it out. But the exact prescription of how to remove a bird cherry tree is going to vary depending on the size of the infestation, the location, the site. So we just encourage that if you have one of these trees, you contact us at Homer Soil and Water. If we go out and verify that you have a tree, and then you cut it down, and then we go out and verify the tree has been removed, you can submit some receipts for alternative ornamentals that you've purchased, and we will reimburse you for $100, up to $100 of replacement purchases. And we have enough funding this year to do that for the first 20 people.
So the first 20 people that call you up or email you saying, I've got some bird cherry, I'd like it removed, what's the process there? So they contact you and then...
Yeah, so basically we want to reduce the amount of cherries that are out there for birds to spread. So we want to encourage you to cut down your tree. The process for getting the $100 reimbursement is you contact us, we come out and survey the property, we confirm you have an invasive tree, then you remove your tree, then we come back out and we confirm that it is removed. And then you are welcome to purchase alternative ornamental plants, trees, shrubs, flowers, and submit those receipts to us, and we will reimburse you for up to $100 of the price of the ornamentals, plus any shipping costs if you had to order out of state.
So that's to cover up the little stump that would be left behind. They can go out and purchase brand new things that'll look nice in its place.
Yeah, and I should warn you that the stumps, if you just cut down the tree, the stump will sucker like mad, and it will be kind of an ugly stump for a while, so that's why it's best to contact us to figure out the best tactic for removing it and dealing with it long term. But that's why, you know, if you are up for the herbicide injection into the stump, and we might be able to supply some support for that as well, then you could get that tree out of there and put a replacement ornamental tree in its location.
Okay, fantastic. And so for those people who'd like their property surveyed or think they might have spotted some of these trees out in public spaces, what's the best way for them to contact you and your team?
So you can email me at katherine@homerswcd.org. So that's katherine at Homer, S as in Sam, W, C, D as in dog, .org. You can give me a call at 907-205-0235. And in general, for invasive species at all that you may find, you can also contact me, or you can call the invasive species hotline, which is 1-877-INVASIVE. That's 468-2748.
And I understand that there's a cool app for your cell phone called the Alaska Invasive Weeds app. ID app. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's great. Cooperative Extension put that out a few years ago, and it's a great little app. You can take a picture with your phone of anything that you found, and then it will upload that picture and your GPS location to Cooperative Extension Service, and they can forward that on to me as well. The way to access that Alaska Weeds ID app is to either go on UAA's Cooperative Extension Service website, or the website for that app is apps.bugwood.org/apps/Alaska.
Okay. Or they could just Google the Weed ID app. And can they get it in the app stores? Or
you can Google the Alaska Weeds ID app.
And it'll just show up.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Katherine. We will be talking with Katherine many more times as the show progresses. There are so many things to know about invasive species and prevention and what we can all do to help our habitat thrive.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Catherine. Nicole. Appreciate it.
Yep. Till next time. I'm Nicola Revelo from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of upcoming garden and local food workshops and events. Today, May 30th, is opening day for the Homer Farmers Market. The market will be open from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. every Saturday through September. The first hour of shopping is reserved for seniors and those at higher risk of complications from COVID-19. Wednesday markets will resume later in the season. Hand washing stations will be provided and masks are encouraged. Head to the market on Ocean Drive for freshly picked flowers, veggies, seafood, plant starts, and more. The Kenai Peninsula's online farmers market, the Alaska Food Hub, is also open. Shoppers can find locally grown foods and handcrafted items each week. The ordering cycle runs from 12 noon on Fridays through the weekend until 10 p.m. on Mondays for a Wednesday customer pickup. Check it out at www.alaskafoodhub.org. The University of Alaska Cooperative Extension has been very busy this spring providing online workshops on topics from gardening to wild plant harvest, preserving food, and raising chickens. Each is free and open to the public. Here are a few you could join this week. On Tuesday, June 2nd, the Matanuska Experiment Farm and Extension Center will be joined by two veterinarians to talk about chicken diseases and maintaining healthy chickens. That's at 6 p.m. On Wednesday, June 3rd, Terrific Tomatoes. This quick 30-minute chat is part of the weekly series In the Virtual Garden with Cooperative Extension, every Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. Saturday, June 6th, Canning Soups and Sauces with Southeast Extension Agent Sarah Lewis, 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. To register for any of these free online workshops, visit www.uaf.edu/ces. And click on the extension blog to find registration links for each workshop. Two other online classes happening this week are Preparing Your Garden for Soil Planting and Warming Your Soil, June 2nd, and Direct Seeding and Transplanting into the Garden, June 4th. Registration for both classes is full, but recordings of the webinars will be posted on the Kenai Cooperative Extension YouTube channel, along with others in the spring series. Look for Kenai Ag Hort on YouTube for these videos. That's Kenai Ag Hort on YouTube. Lots of great topics covered this season. This has been your weekly roundup for Homer Grown.
Thank you for joining us for the first episode of Homer Grown. The topic for our next episode will be dirt and soil. If you have questions, comments, or if you are a local farmer or producer and would like to be featured on this show, you can email Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I would like to thank Carrie Restino of Hilltop Farm for her interview on May the 17th, 2020. Brad Kassar of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District for providing this week's Tech Minute. And Catherine Shakey, also of Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, for her interview with Nicole Arevalo regarding invasive European bird cherries. This show was produced by Nicole Arevalo and produced and edited by Desiree Hagen. I would also like to acknowledge and thank Carly Konimak and Kevin Cope for providing the music for this episode. And I would like to send us off with their music. As always, this is listener-supported public radio, KBBI Homer AM 890. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer.